From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Senator Kirk has just joined the Rogues Gallery for the president's fiercest and most unhinged critics. And for that, he should be ashamed. What he said is beneath the dignity of the office he now holds, and Senator Kirk should apologize immediately to the President of the United States as well as to the people of Illinois.
Do you want to apologize for your statement? Or?
Not at all. I would say that when my opponent called me unhinged for criticizing the president, on that, I would say it is unhinged to give $400 million in cash to terrorists.
Well, I'm really not focused heavily on any kind of electioneering right now. I am a fan of Senator Kirk. I believe he's done an outstanding job. As I said the other day, he's a strong advocate for our safety. He's a strong advocate to keep Iran from becoming a nuclear power, which is, to me, a very big deal for our safety and the world's safety. So I'm an advocate. In terms of electioneering, I'm really not focused on that.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner not wanting to get in the middle of a scrap between the Democrat Tammy Duckworth and Republican Mark Kirk. The fight is on in the race for the U.S. Senate. Also this week, a state Supreme Court decision makes it look less likely Illinois will change its controversial redistricting process anytime soon. And public employee pensions back in the news. We'll talk about that and more today. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Amanda Vinicky, our State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, and Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio reporter. And joining us again today, Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Chris, good to have you back again.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
Chris, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. A court opinion this week talked about, or it was regarding a question that could have been put on the ballot. It would have let voters decide if Illinois should change how it divides political boundaries, also known as redistricting. It would have let a commission handle that instead of the current process. Any surprise in what the court had to say?
Well, historically, the court has interpreted the very narrow constitutional provision for initiative in the state very narrowly. So you got a narrow provision, and they interpret it very narrowly. This is an extraordinarily narrow interpretation of it, but it's the one that the framers gave us, and so to any initiative is going to have a difficult time getting over that threshold. I think if anything would, it might be some form of a redistricting approach. Now, you might say, well, these people put all this money into the signature petitions, and they should have hired a few lawyers. Last time it was worse. They had more loose ends. This time the whole throwing the case out hinges on bringing in the Auditor General, who is a legislative officer, but it just so happens the Auditor General is discussed in the Constitution in a different provision of the Constitution in a legislative article, and the initiative provision says that it can only deal with the legislative article. So that's what the court, at least the Democrats on the court, found that that was enough to toss the whole thing.
And Charlie, the Republicans didn't agree.
Well, no, they, and as a matter of fact, in the dissent, in a kind of a short dissent that concurred with the longer dissent by Justice Carmeier, Justice Thomas was quite outspoken about how he thought the will of the people was being trampled on by the majority opinion, and he suggested that they should put a big red sticker over that section of the Constitution saying that this is not operable because of this court opinion. He thought it should be construed more broadly, I guess. But if you look at it and read it very closely, the reasoning in the majority, in the opinion written by Justice Kilbride, is not unreasonable because, in fact, this particular proposal would put new duties on the Auditor General. And the Auditor General is mentioned in the finance article, not the legislative article. And the intent of the people who framed the Constitution, who wrote this, was not to have the kind of wide-open initiative that you have in places like California. They wanted to limit it very narrowly, and the particular topics that were discussed at the time included things like, should we have cumulative voting, which at the time we did, and the voters opted to retain it back in 1970, but then in 1980, the cutback amendment did away with it. Should we have a a one-chamber legislature like Nebraska be unicameral as opposed to having two chambers, a Senate and a House. And the delegate said these are the kind of issues that this article was intended to address. And in a questioning from the floor, the delegate who presented this article agreed that redistricting would be a topic that would fit within this. But the difficulty for the people who've been framing these petitions is that 2 years ago, they included a provision saying that if you serve on this commission, you can't run for, say, governor in the future for 10 years. And the court said, well, that imposes a new condition, new eligibility requirement for governor. And the governor is in the executive article. And now what the majority is saying is you're imposing new duties on the Auditor General. He's appointed by the General Assembly, but that is contained in the finance article, not in the legislative article. And this very narrow window says you have to deal with the legislative article, both procedural and substantive.
Well, Brian, Amanda, let me bring you in on this, because it seems to me that despite, even though Charlie could be very well right, and the justices as well on their opinion on why this should not take place, it is clear that a lot of people think the system is broken, of how the state divides up political boundaries, and that something needs to change. Are they just at the, going to have to sit there and wait for the will of the political establishment to do something?
Yeah, when you say a lot of people, I guess that depends. I think a lot of Republicans who have been largely not benefited from the way maps are drawn in Illinois have problems with that. And I think a lot of Democrats are probably pretty satisfied with the status quo there is in Illinois. But this certainly is something that the governor has picked up on. He doesn't talk about this so-called independent maps group nearly as much as he likes to talk about term limits, because I think that term limits is something that most voters probably can understand a little more easily than the gerrymandering process. And it's just a better political issue for him, even though that's even probably more of a remote possibility for changing the Constitution. It's certainly something that I think we'll continue to hear about, because a significant number of voters and their representatives in Illinois, i.e. those in the Republican Party, are not benefiting under the current circumstances.
And, it's kind of it's not just the Republicans that are interested in some kind of revision of this process. It does seem to be pretty extreme. The Democrats really, I think, are in some sense overplaying their hand on this, because I don't think – they're getting a few more marginal districts. They string those things out into the suburbs and they get to pick up some – now they've got a senator who's got part of DuPage and so forth. But really it's the demographics that are driving these things. And on the margin you can change things with mapping, but you can't fight – you can't fight demographics, and the Democrats are, increasingly solid in that respect. They're not, I have a hard time believing today, as opposed to 1990, when the last time the Republicans set up the map, that you could draw a map in this state that passes a constitutional muster that would give the Republicans a majority in both chambers. I just don't think you could do it.
And Amanda?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, so first of all, even though I think we've said this, but just to make clear, this is for redistricting for the legislative districts themselves. And there is a difference as we're looking so closely at this language and what the Supreme Court has ruled on. If the General Assembly were to ever deem to put this on the ballot, which, fat chance, I can't imagine that happening. Legislators like having this power themselves. But nonetheless, if they were to, they have a lot more freedom to be able to make any changes. It's just this citizens' initiative that is at play, and how rare those citizens' initiatives really are. We will have one constitutional amendment on the November ballot, and that's one that was put there by the General Assembly themselves. I do think that this decision gives people that are upset at the system even more research to kind of back that up with, or more credibility to that argument, just given that how the split broke down. Technically, the Supreme Court, once you're on it, you're nonpartisan. And yet, of course, these justices were elected on partisan ballots, and the split was a partisan one. Democrats all going along with the people who were represented, the quote unquote people's map. That was the group of minority business executives and such that had gotten as their attorney, Mike Casper, who is also the attorney for the Democratic Party of Illinois and tightly aligned with House Speaker Michael Madigan. Madigan, careful with his words in terms of speaking about his involvement with this, and said, you know, just Mike Casper is a well-known attorney. That's how they got him. And so I think that that divide there on partisan lines is going to give particularly skeptics and Republicans even more fodder, and we're not going to see this going away. If you look at, for example, term limits, no chance of that being on the November ballot whatsoever. And yet, Governor Bruce Rauner and Republicans pouring millions of dollars, or maybe not quite that yet, but into an effort to try and get a quote-unquote petition signed, really it appears to just be a data-collecting drive and drumming up support, building up antagonism against Madigan and the Democrats. One can expect that the word gerrymandering will be used as part of that, too, going forward.
And I just want to add there, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily – it's worth saying, even though this is not going to happen now, that this may not be a panacea for voter satisfaction. I have seen political science research that said voters are generally more satisfied if the people they vote for get to win. And so there may be actually a better argument for having, instead of 51-49 districts that go one way or the other, for having more 70-30, 60-40 districts, because then more people get to vote for politicians who – you know, will espouse their beliefs and take their beliefs into the legislative process.
However, doesn't it get back to that point that a lot of these districts are not competitive, so people often don't run in them? So you're, what is it, 70% of the House districts, I believe, don't have any, you know, any opposition this fall. So, I mean, it gets back to that part of, is this really democracy?
Well, but I would pick up on something that Chris said. A lot of it is driven by demographics. When I started out as a reporter, you know, back in the Ice Age, South Cook County, where Brian is from, was solidly Republican.
Go White Sox.
Sorry about that, Brian.
Yeah, thanks.
Go guaranteed rates.
And then in the matter of maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 years, it began to change as the African-American community on the south side of Chicago began to move into those south suburbs. And for a period of 10 years or so, those districts were competitive. Now, they're solidly Democratic. The same thing with the town of Cicero. Once upon a time, Cicero was probably the most Republican township in Cook County. Now, it's solidly Democratic because it's changed. It's no longer Bohemians and Czechs and people from Central Europe who make up most of the folks living there. Now it's mostly Hispanics. The same thing, the reason why Democrats were able to elect senators from districts in the early 2000s in Kane County, because of the growth of the Hispanic population out there. First time in state history. So demographics drives it, and you're not going to be able to make competitive districts in many parts of the state. You're not going to have a district centered in central Illinois, say Bloomington, Normal, McLean County, that's going to elect a Democrat, any more than you're going to get a district on the south side of Chicago that's going to elect a Republican.
Yeah, and the argument I think that people who are opposed to this process would make is that sometimes what may seem, you know, just if you to common sense, like you want to have, shouldn't the city of Springfield be its own district and Decatur can be a district? Well, there's a large African-American population in Springfield, not enough to elect a representative. And there's, you know, a population in Decatur and maybe Champaign and Bloomington. And so by combining districts, you give that community a chance to have somebody represent their views. And so, you know, it's a way of, they say, protecting minority voting rights, African-Americans, Latinos, other minorities.
But couldn't a commission still do that? I mean, couldn't they sit down and say, okay, we need to carve out, you know, some niches
sure.
here?
Theoretically,
for-
yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah. And they could come up with maps even more gerrymandered than the ones we have. I mean, they would have guidelines, and one of the guidelines would be that you have to give minority voters the opportunity to elect representatives of their choice. So you have to try and maximize the number of minority districts that you can have.
But, of course, this is shockingly have some – basically comes down to politics now. So it's just another club that the governor and his you know, can beat the Democrats about the head and shoulders with over the course of the next couple of months in this election. And people – you know, they may not – I mean, term limits is something that's fairly simple, as you mentioned, Sean, but redistricting is – it's complicated in a lot of ways. When this has been – Ohio and California, for example, they had some redistricting reforms that were put on the ballot because they've got a much more open initiative process in those states. And they didn't pass several times. I mean, Schwarzenegger went to the – you know, went to the mat on this thing and lost a couple of times until they finally passed it in California. So it's not a done deal. But the fact that they can now just say, the governor can now just say, the Democrats are thwarting the will of the people, that's all he needs.
Brian, before we move along, real quick, can you give us just an update on another decision this week that will impact the ballot, at least in some communities, the 13th Congressional District?
Yeah, there's a man down here named David Gill. The 13th Congressional District goes from the Mississippi River all the way over to Champaign, takes in parts of Bloomington, Decatur, Springfield. David Gill has run for Congress at least four times before, three against Tim Johnson, and then he ran in 2012 against Rodney Davis, who was then just appointed to that seat, and Davis won in a very tight election. Okay, fast forward to this year. Gill comes back. He wants to run as an independent this time. Illinois law sets up a very high threshold. If you are the Republican or a Democrat, you want to run for Congress in the 13th district, you only needed to get about 740 signatures, valid signatures. If you want to be an independent or a third-party candidate, you have to gather almost 15 times as many signatures, 10,700 and change. And Gill did not get that. And he filed more signatures than that, but as often happens, somebody challenged it. A number of those signatures were invalid, and he was going to be tossed off the ballot. He sued, and this week, a federal judge, Sue Myerscough, here in Springfield, ruled that it's an unconstitutional burden to make it so much harder for independents. And sitting through the court hearing, Gill's lawyer presented some of the debate that happened in 1983, which is the last time they kind of toughened this requirement. And I should say there's even more things that make it a little more challenging. Each petition form has to be notarized. You have to there's only a 90-day window when you can pass petitions. And the judge, asked a number of tough questions. She herself had run for office in the past. And there was a snippet of the debate that they read out from 1983 and state representative said, we're doing this. We're adding the 90-day requirement because people are back passing petitions in your district while you're working hard down here, and this is to help you guys out. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. And so I think that the judge basically said, even though this is preliminary, this isn't necessarily striking down the law in Illinois, but it does allow this candidate, David Gill, to get on the ballot and could pave the way if he pursues this case and there is a constitutional ruling later on or somebody else tries to pursue this line of argument. It could really potentially open up the ballot to more independent candidates in Illinois.
And Charlie was there for that earlier debate, I'll bet, in 83.
Yep. And this is one of the areas, nowadays one of the few areas, where Republicans and Democrats both agree. We have this kind of, what would you call it, not a monopoly, a biopoly,
oligarchy.
We control the process and we don't want anybody else in. So we're going to make it really, really hard for you as an independent or you as a libertarian or you as a Green Party candidate or you as whatever to be able to get on the ballot because that's our role as being established political parties. And a few years ago, the Green Party candidate for governor got enough of a percentage of the gubernatorial vote so that the Green Party, the next election cycle, was an established political party, and it didn't have to get the extraordinary requirement. And then they didn't meet that threshold again, so now they're back having to get 15 times as many signatures as a Republican or a Democrat to run for office.
Yeah, and I think this is another example, like with the sort of extreme, some would say gerrymandering we get there. In this case, both parties are overreaching. I think in that case, the single party is overreaching because, why not let them on? I mean, sometimes you get a spoiler situation, but 90%, 99% of the races, it's not going to make any difference. Americans don't vote for third-party candidates en masse, and independents can be successful under very limited personality-based situations. So why, and that's what the court, and as Myerscough held, is that, 10,000 versus 700 doesn't make any sense. They could easily have said, you know, 5,000, 3,000. It's still a lot. It'd still be difficult to do. Probably wouldn't make any difference, but they overreached.
All right. Go ahead, Bob.
I was just going to add, I think we've seen this year, it is a better route, if whether you're Donald Trump or, you know, who made it. Kind of stage an insurgency with the Republican Party. Bruce Rauner did the same thing a few years ago. He wasn't really an established Republican player. And we almost saw Bernie Sanders do it. So I think politicians are taking the more go through the major parties route rather than trying to mount independent candidacies nowadays, too.
Well, at the top of the show, we heard from Tammy Duckworth and Mark Kirk, the Democrat and Republican respectively running for the U.S. Senate. Amanda Vinicky, it sounds like it's on between the two of them.
Most definitely. I think it's been on, although truly both candidates were really more quiet and weren't campaigning a lot, weren't having a lot of open press appearances. And in fact, the comments that really kicked this off, Mark Kirk, were made at the State Journal Register editorial board. And that was when he compared Obama, as we heard, to, quote, drug dealer in chief. That was, he said, in regards to the payments that the United States made that Republicans say are akin to having paid ransom, something that is not in practice for the country. Tammy Duckworth then at the City Club of Chicago calling Kirk, quote unquote, unhinged. And then it's really just been a back and forth spiraling from there with Kirk saying that that apparently he believes was a kind of veiled remark at his disability as he is recovered now from having a stroke. And then Duckworth firing back at him, no, that that is not in fact what she was saying, and he shouldn't be hiding behind a stroke. And in fact, she says he didn't accomplish much as a senator even before that medical emergency. So really, that has been the draw. Yet again, we continue to see it really being a war of words versus a war of actual policy or commentary, though I suppose the Iran situation really is at the root of things, and you do see a difference between Duckworth and Kirk there.
Chris, let me throw this to you, because it seems to me they both saw an opportunity here to appeal to the base. I mean, you know, certainly Kirk could go after President Obama, so that certainly fires up a lot of the Republicans, which he has not made many of them happy this year with some of his decisions, especially not to support Donald Trump. And then also you have Tammy Duckworth sort of coming to the defense of Obama, who is somewhat, you know, still popular here in Illinois. So they both really, I think, saw political opportunity here.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an example, really, I mean, in small of what we're seeing at the national level. You've got two candidates who aren't really super popular. They don't have a lot to say necessarily that is going to appeal to the broad base. And maybe it's just because of the way politics is this year. But they're just constantly picking at each other. And really, in some sense, it also parallels because you've got the Republican candidate in both at the presidential level and at the U.S. Senate level that has a tendency to say some stuff that gets him in trouble, right? You know, Kirk may not be as bad off as Trump in that respect, but he spouts off from time to time, and he's gotten himself in trouble over the years. And Duckworth jumps on it, and then, you know, and just everything just escalates like instantaneously to, you know, the nuclear level. And we see that like this week with Clinton and Trump with this claims of racism. And it's just a symptom of what's going on this year. It just makes it very difficult, I think, for most of us to pay close attention to what's going on in politics.
And I have to say, I mean, it seems to me that voters have clearly found refreshing, or at least they did originally, Trump's what they saw as being honest and telling it like it is. And yet there is a limit to that, particularly when your opponent wants to take it there and amplify any of those comments. And truly, some people find it, again, refreshing. Others find it completely and patently offensive. And this is also, I think, where the media needs to get perhaps a little bit introspective in terms of how much that story carries, how long you take it, how the presidential campaign has covered, and how much these remarks, again, matter when it comes to policy. And yet, of course, when you have somebody that is running for a very high office, anything that they say does and should matter.
Well, Amanda, let me go back to you real quick here, because before we go from our notes from the field, pensions got some notice again this week. The governor talked quickly about that in passing, almost saying that they had been discussing this, he and some of the top lawmakers. What do we know about some of those discussions on public employee pensions?
Well, so Sean, we actually have kind of pension news going on two fronts. The one that is getting a lot of attention is ongoing even as we tape, and that is in regards to the state's largest public pension system, the Teachers Retirement System, or TRS, and whether it is going to change the assumptions on its investment returns, something that if it did occur, if those assumptions were lowered, Illinois would be sacked with having to pay millions more, obviously in a tight budget situation. So that is something that, again, is ongoing. And then that, even as that goes on, you have Governor Bruce Rauner saying that there have been meetings and progress has been made on a overall state pension plan overhaul. That is something that is the only way that Chicago public schools will get $215 million to pay into its pension systems. Remember, every other school district in the state picks up the employer's share for retirement benefits, but not for CPS. CPS says it wants to get on a level playing field. This wouldn't get it there, but their budget that was just approved on Wednesday is counting on that money coming from the state. The only way that CPS gets that money is if the state passes a pension overhaul. Rauner didn't get into detail, but it seemed to me like he was alluding to the previous agreement he'd worked out with Senate President John Cullerton, where it would be this quote-unquote consideration model. Basically, state employees given an option. You can keep your current benefits, but then have to forego any future pay raises being pensionable. He, again, didn't get into that detail, and once again, sort of criticized the legislature, saying he's not sure there's the political will for it to pass. But a change dynamic, obviously, given the pressure that will be on Chicago legislators to get something done so that CPS can get that money.
All right. Let's go from our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, I was going to add something to what Amanda said. It's not really a note from the field. But the thing to remember is if the teacher's retirement system changes its expected rate of return, it does not affect the unfunded liability. The unfunded liability for all the pension systems is currently standing, the most recent official estimates, at $111 billion. That is $111 billion that is going to have to be found at some point in the future, not tomorrow, not the day after, but sometime over the next 30, 40 years.
So, Charlie, why do they would have to pay more right now then?
Because the amount that is required to be put in by law each year is a calculation that takes into account, among other things, the money that we have now that we're investing, what kind of interest, what kind of rate of return can we get on our investments? A couple years ago, teachers' retirement system dropped their expected rate of return from 8% to 7.5% over time, and that meant that for that year, we had to put another $200 million in to make sure that at the end of, well, what would it be now? Well, 40 years from 1995, we have the 90% of the dollars there that are needed to pay the liabilities owed to the people who are pensioners.
Amanda Vinicky.
Illinois no longer has a quote-unquote pink tax. Governor Bruce Rauner signed into law a measure that says there no longer needs to be any sales tax charged on tampons and other feminine products.
All right. Brian, let me go to you real quick.
Yeah, there's a lawsuit against Fox TV in Cook County over the TV show Empire, apparently causing a two-week lockdown at the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. The show charged, according to the lawsuit, $750,000 for each 30-second advertisement. Meanwhile, the kids had to miss 2 weeks of school, family visits, rehabilitation programs, and recreation opportunities.
All for show business.
That's right.
All right. Members of our broadcast today include Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and our guest Chris Mooney. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org. You can also find us on NPR One. Look for State Week. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR. Illinois Public Radio.